So let's obey the golden rule and give unto others what we would have others give unto us. How? When? Where? Well, the answer is all the time, everywhere.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
It's Violet Benson, your favorite meme queen and the big sis you didn't ask for but need. Welcome to Almost Adulting.
Almost Adulting. Almost Adulting.
Are you ready?
Hi, besties, and welcome to a brand new Almost Adulting, the largest self-love podcast and movement, your number one destination for personal growth and mental health. I'm your big sister and your host, Violetta. Welcome to a brand new Benson Book Club. As you know, every Tuesday, I now am going to be doing Benson Book Club. Since I'm writing a book this year, I've decided to dedicate my Tuesdays to books. I will now be sharing every Tuesday some of my favorite books and some of my favorite chapters from those books where we can learn a lot from it, find peace, find knowledge, and so much more. The way I choose these chapters and these books is all based on whatever topic we are covering that month on the podcast. So today I will be sharing with you how to make people like you instantly. This is from the book How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Okay, chapter 6, how to make people like you instantly. I was waiting in line to register a letter in the post office at 33rd Street and 8th Avenue, New York. I noticed that the clerk appeared to be bored with the job, weighing envelopes, handing out stamps, making change, issuing receipts, the same mundaneous grind year after year. So I said to myself, I am going to try to make this clerk like me. Obviously, to make him like me, I must say something nice, not about myself, but about him. So I asked myself, what is there about him that I can honestly admire? That is sometimes a hard question to answer, especially with strangers, but in this case, it happened to be easy. I instantly saw something I admired no end. So while he was weighing an envelope, I remarked with enthusiasm, I certainly wish I had your head of hair. He looked up, half startled, his face beaming with smiles. Well, it isn't as good as it used to be, he said modestly. I assured him that although it might have lost some of its pristine glory, nonetheless, it was still magnificent. He was immensely pleased. We carried on a pleasant little conversation. The last thing that he said to me was, many people have admired my hair. I'll bet that that person went out to lunch that day walking on air. I'll bet that he went home that night and told his wife about it. I'll bet that he looked in the mirror and said, it is a beautiful head of hair. I told this story once in public, and the man asked me afterwards, what did you want to get out of him? What was I trying to get out of him? If we are so selfish that we can't radiate a little bit of happiness and pass on a bit of honest appreciation without trying to get something out of the other person in return, if our souls are no bigger than sour crap apples, we should meet with the failure we so richly deserve. Oh, yes, I did want something out of that chap. I wanted something priceless, and I got it. I got the feeling that I had done something for him without him being able to do anything, whatever, in return for me. That is a feeling that flows and sings in your memory long after the incident is past. There is one all-important law of human conduct. If we obey that law, we shall almost never get into trouble. In fact, that law, if we obeyed, will bring us countless friends and constant happiness. But the very instant that we break that law, we shall get into endless trouble. The law is this: always make the other person feel important. John Dewey, as we have already noticed, said that the desire to be important is the deepest urge in human nature. And William James said, the deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated. As I've already pointed out, it is the urge that differentiates us from animals. It is the urge that has been responsible for civilization itself. Philosophers have been speculating on the rules of human relationships for thousands of years, and out of all of that speculation, there has evolved only one important precept. It is not new. It is as old as history. Zoroaster taught to his followers in Persia 2,500 years ago. Confucius preached it in China 24 centuries ago. Lao Tzu taught it to his disciples in the Valley of the Han. Buddha preached it on the bank of the Holy Ganges 500 years before Christ. The sacred book of Hinduism taught it 1,000 years before that. Jesus taught it among the stony hills of Judea 19 centuries ago. Jesus summed it up in one thought, probably the most important rule in the world. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. You want the approval of those with whom you come in contact. You want recognition of your true worth. You want a feeling that you are important in your little world. You don't want to listen to some cheap, insincere flattery, but you do crave sincere appreciation. You want your friends and associates to be, as Charles Schwab put it, hearty in their approbation, lavish in their praise. All of us want that. So let's obey the golden rule and give unto others what we would have others give unto us. How? When? Where? Well, the answer is all the time, everywhere. David G. Smith of EU Clare, Wisconsin, told one of our classes how he handled a delicate situation where he was asked to take charge of the refreshment booth at a charity concert. The night of the concert, I arrived at a park and found two elderly ladies in a very bad humor standing next to the refreshment stand. Apparently, each thought that she was in charge of this project. As I stood there pondering what to do, one of the members of the sponsorship committee appeared and handed me a cash box and thanked me for taking over the project. She introduced Rose and Jane as my helpers and then ran off. A great silence ensued. Realizing that the cash box was a symbol of authority of some sort, I gave the box to Rose and explained that I might not be able to keep the money straight and that if she took care of it, I will feel better. I then suggested to Jane that she shows two teenagers who have been assigned to the refreshments how to operate the soda machine, and I asked her to be responsible for that part of the project. The evening was very enjoyable, with Rose happily counting the money, Jane supervising the teenagers, and me enjoying the concert. You don't have to wait until you are ambassador to France or the chairman of some committee of your lodge before you use this philosophy of appreciation. You can work magic with it almost every single day. If, for example, the waitress brings us mashed potatoes when we have ordered French fries, let's say, "I'm sorry to trouble you, but I prefer French fries." She'll probably reply, "No trouble at all." And then we'll be glad to change the potatoes because we have shown some respect. Little phrases such as, "I'm sorry to trouble you. Would you be so kind as to, won't you please, do you mind, thank you." Little courtesies like these oil the cogs of a mundane grind of everyday life. And incidentally, they are the hallmark of good breeding. Let's take another illustration, okay? Hall Caine's novels, The Christian, The Dimster, The Manxman, and among them were all bestsellers in the early part of the century. Millions of people read his novels, countless millions. He was the son of a blacksmith. He never had more than 8 years schooling in his life. Yet when he died, he was the richest literary man of his time. The story goes like this. Hall Caine loved sonnets and ballads, so he devoured all of the Dante Gabriel's Rossetti's poetry. He even wrote a lecture chanting the praises of Rossetti's artistic achievements. And then he sent a copy to Rossetti himself. Rossetti was so delighted. "Any young man who has such an excelled opinion of my ability," Rossetti probably said to himself, "must be brilliant." So Rossetti invited this blacksmith's son to come to London and act as his secretary. That was the turning point in Hall Caine's life. For his new position, he met the literary artists of the day, profiting by their advice and inspired by their encouragement. He launched upon a career that shouted his name across the sky. His home, Gribbe Castle, and the Isle of Man became a mecca for tourists from the far corners of the world. And then he left a multi-million dollar estate. Yet, who knows? He might have died poor and unknown had he not written an essay expressing his admiration for a famous person. Such is the power of sincere, heartfelt appreciation. Rossetti considered himself important. That is not strange. Almost everyone considers themselves important, very important. The life of many a person could probably be changed if only someone would make them feel important. Ronald J. Rowland, who is one of the instructors of our course in California, is also a teacher of the arts and crafts. He wrote to us about a student named Chris in his beginning crafts class. Chris was a very quiet, shy boy, lacking in self-confidence, the kind of student that often does not receive the attention he deserves. I also teach an advanced class that he had grown to be somewhat of a status symbol and a privilege for a student to have earned the right to be in it. On Wednesday, Chris was delightedly working at his desk. I really felt there was a hidden fire deep inside him, so I asked Chris if he would like to be in my advanced class. How I wish I could express the look in Chris's face, the emotions in that shy 14-year-old boy trying to hold back his tears. Who, me? Mr. Roland, am I good enough? Yes, Chris, you are good enough. I had to leave at that point because tears were coming down my eyes. As Chris walked out of the class that day, seemingly 2 inches taller, he looked at me with bright blue eyes and said in a positive voice, "Thank you, Mr. Roland." Chris taught me a lesson that I will never forget, our deep desire to feel important. To help me never forget this rule, I made a sign which reads, "You are important." This sign hangs in front of the classroom for all to see and to remind me that each student I face is equally important. The truth is that almost all people you meet feel themselves superior to you in some way, and a sure way to their hearts is to let them realize, in some subtle way, that you recognize their importance and you recognize it sincerely. Remember what Emerson said, "Every man I meet is my superior in some way, and in that I learn from him." And the pathetic part of this is that frequently those who have the least justification for a feeling of achievement bolster up their egos by a show of tumult and conceit, which is truly nauseating. As Shakespeare put this, "Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep." I am going to tell you how business people in my own courses have applied these principles with remarkable results. Okay, so let's take the case of Connecticut attorney because of his relatives. He prefers not to have his name mentioned. Shortly after joining the course, Mr. R drove to Long Island with his wife to visit some of his relatives. She left him to chat with an old aunt of hers, and then she rushed off by herself to visit some of the younger relatives. Since he soon had to give a speech professionally on how he applied the principles of appreciation, he thought he would gain some worthwhile experience talking with the elderly lady. So he looked around the house to see what he could honestly admire. The house was built about 1890s, wasn't it? He inquired. "Yes," she replied. "That is precisely the year it was built." "It reminds me of the house I was born in," he said. "It's beautiful, well-built, roomy, you know. They don't build houses like this anymore." "You're right," the old lady agreed. "The young folks nowadays just don't care for beautiful homes. All they want is smaller apartments, and then they go off gating about it in their automobiles." "This is a dream house," she said, in a voice vibrating with tender memories. "This house was built with love. My husband and I dreamt about it for years before we built it. We didn't have an architect. We planned it all ourselves." She showed Mr. R about the house, and he expressed his hearty admiration for the beautiful treasure she had picked up in her travels and cherished over a lifetime. Paisley shawls, an old English tea set, Wedgwood china, fresh French beds and chairs, Italian paintings, and silk draperies that had once hung in a French chateau. After showing Mr. R through the house, she took him out to the garage. There, jacked up on blocks, was Packard's car in mint condition. "My husband bought that car for me shortly before he passed on," she said softly. "I have never ridden in it since his death. You appreciate nice things, and I'm going to give this car to you." "Why, auntie," he said, "you overwhelm me. I appreciate your generosity, of course, but I couldn't possibly accept it. I'm not even a relative of yours. I have a new car, and you have many relatives that would like to have that Packard." "Relatives?" she exclaimed. "Yes, I have relatives who just are waiting till I die so they can get this car, but they are not going to get it." "If you don't want to give it to them, you can very easily just sell it in mint condition," he told her. "Sell it?" she cried. "Do you think I would sell this car? Do you think I could stand to see strangers riding up and down the street in my car, the car that my husband bought for me? I wouldn't dream of selling it. I'm going to give it to you. You appreciate beautiful things." He tried to get out of accepting that car, but he couldn't without hurting her feelings. This lady, left all alone in a big house with her paisley shawls, her French antiques, and her memories, was starving for a little recognition. She had once been young and beautiful and sought after. She had once built a house warm with love and had collected things from all over Europe to make it beautiful. Now, in this isolated loneliness of old age, she craved a little human warmth, a little genuine appreciation. And no one gave it to her. And when she found it, like a spring in the desert, her gratitude couldn't adequately express itself with anything less than the gift of her cherished Packard. Let's take another case, okay? Donald M. McMahon, who was superintendent of Lewis and Valentine, nurseryman and landscape architect in Rye, New York, related this incident. Shortly after I attended the talk on how to win friends and influence people, I was landscaping the estate of a famous attorney. The owner came out to give me a few instructions about where he wished to plant a mass of various flowers. I said, "Judge, you have a lovely hobby. I've been admiring your beautiful dogs, and I understand that you win a lot of blue ribbons every single year at the show in Madison Square Garden." The effect of this little expression of appreciation was striking. "Yes," the judge replied. "I do have a lot of fun with my dogs. Would you like to see my kennel?" He spent almost an hour showing me his dogs and the prizes that he had won. He even brought out their pedigrees and explained about the bloodlines responsible for such beauty and intelligence. Finally, turning to me, he asked, "Do you have any small children?" "Yes, I do," I replied. "I have a son." "Well, would he like a puppy?" the judge inquired. Yes, he would be tickled pink." "All right. Well, I'm going to give him one," the judge announced. He started to tell me how to feed the puppy, then he paused. "You'll forget if I tell you. I'll just write it out for you." So the judge went in the house, typed out the pedigree and feeding instructions, and gave me a puppy worth several hundreds of dollars and 1 hour and 15 minutes of his valuable time, largely because I had expressed my honest admiration for his hobby and achievements. George Eastman of Kodak fame invented the transparent film that made a motion pictures possible. Amassed a fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars and made himself one of the most famous businessmen on earth. Yet, in spite of all these tremendous accomplishments, he craved a little recognition, even as you and I. To illustrate, when Eastman was building the Eastman School of Music and also the hall in Rochester, James Adamson, then president of the Superior Sitting Company of New York, wanted to get the order to supply the theater chairs for this building. Phoning the architect, Mr. Admison made an appointment to see Mr. Eastman in Rochester. When Admison arrived, the architect said, "I know you want to get this order, but I can tell you right now that you won't stand a ghost of a show if you take more than 5 minutes of George Eastman's time. He's very strict. He's very busy. So tell your story quickly and then get out." Admison was prepared to do just that. So when he was ushered into the room, he saw Mr. Eastman bending over a pile of paper at his desk. Presently, Mr. Eastman looked up, removed his glasses, and walked toward the architect and Mr. Admison, saying, "Good morning, gentlemen. What can I do for you?" The architect introduced them, and then Mr. Admison said, "While we've been waiting for you, Mr. Admison, I've been admiring your office. I wouldn't mind working in a room like this myself. I'm in the interior woodworking business, and I never saw a more beautiful office in my whole life." George Eastman replied, "You remind me of something I'd almost forgotten. It is beautiful, isn't it? I enjoyed it a great deal when it was first built, but I come down here now with a lot of other things in my mind, and sometimes I don't really see the room for weeks at a time." Admison walked over and rubbed his hand across a panel. "This is English oak, right? A little different texture from Italian oak." "Yes," Eastman replied. "Imported English oak. It was selected for me by a friend who specializes in fine woods." Then Eastman showed him about the room, commenting on the proportions, the coloring, the hand carving, and other effects he had helped to plan and execute. While drifting about the room, admiring the woodwork, they paused before a window, and George Eastman, in his modest, soft-spoken way, pointed out some of the institutions through which he was trying to help humanity. The University of Rochester, the General Hospital, this other hospital, the Friendly Home, the Children's Hospital. Mr. Admison congratulated him warmly on this idealistic way he was using his wealth to elevate the suffering of humanity. Presently, George Eastman unlocked a glass case and pulled out the first camera he had ever owned, an invention he had bought from an Englishman. Admison questioned at a length about his early struggles to get started in business, and Mr. Eastman spoke with real feeling about the poverty of his childhood, telling him how his widowed mother had kept a boarding house while he clerked in an insurance office. The terror of poverty haunted him day and night, and he resolved to make enough money so that his mother would never have to work again. Mr. Admison drew him out with further questions and listened, absorbed, while he related the story of his experiments with dry photographic plates. He told how he had to work in an office all day and sometimes experimented all night, taking only brief naps while the chemicals were working, sometimes working and sleeping in his clothes for 72 hours at a stretch. James Amundson had been ushered into Eastman's office at 10:15 and had been warned that he must not take more than 5 minutes. But an hour had passed, then 2 hours had passed, and they were still talking. Finally, George Eastman turned to Amundson and said, "The last time I was in Japan, I bought some chairs. I brought them home and I put them in my sun porch. But the sun peeled the paint, so I went downtown the other day and I bought some paint and I painted the chairs myself. Would you like to see what sort of job I can do painting chairs? All right. Come up to my home and have lunch with me and I'll show you." After lunch, Mr. Eastman showed Amundson the chairs he had bought from Japan. They weren't worth more than a few dollars. But George Eastman, now a millionaire, was proud of them because he himself had painted them. The order for the seats amounted to $90,000. Who do you suppose got the order? James Amundson or one of his competitors? For the time of this story, until Mr. Eastman's death, he and James Amundson were close friends. Mr. Claude, a restaurant owner in Rouen, France, used this principle and saved his restaurant and the loss of a key employee. This woman had been his employee for 5 years and was a vital link between Mr. Claude and his staff of 21 people. He was shocked to receive a registered letter from her advising him of her resignation. Mr. Claude reported, "I was very surprised and even more disappointed because I was under the impression that I had been fair to her and receptive to her needs. In so much as she was a friend as well as an employee, I probably had taken her too much for granted and maybe I was even more demanding of her than other employees. I could not, of course, accept this resignation without some explanation, so I took her aside and I said, 'Paulette, you must understand that I cannot accept your resignation. You mean a great deal to me in this company, and you are as important to the success of this restaurant as I am.' I repeated this in front of the entire staff, and then I invited her to my home and reiterated my confidence in her with my family present. Paulette withdrew her resignation, and today I can rely on her as never before. I frequently reinforce this by expressing my appreciation for what she does and showing her how important she is to me in the restaurant. Talk to people about themselves." One of the shrewdest men who have ever ruled the British Empire, Mr. Disraeli, said, "And they will listen to you for hours." So the principle here is this: make the other person feel important, but do it sincerely. So in a nutshell, there are 6 ways to make people like you. Principle number 1, become genuinely interested in other people. Principle number 2, smile. Principle number 3, remember that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Principle number 4, be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Principle number 5, talk in terms of other person's interests. Principle number 6, make the other person feel important and do it sincerely. So the reason that I loved this chapter and I did my best trying to read it is because it is such a simple, easy way to make other people like us, but we constantly seem to forget it because all of us love talking about ourselves. And sometimes we don't realize that everyone else likes the same thing as well. And that is actually how in the past I have gotten some jobs. When I was an accountant, the way I was able to get my job through interviews was I made sure to constantly know loads of information about the people who were interviewing me. I was constantly asking them questions about their lives. And then I was figuring out ways to connect what I was looking to do in the job with their past. It showed them how important they were to me. Not only did I know everyone's names, but I knew all of their backgrounds. I did my research before I walked into the interviews. And that was how I got my job. When I was an accountant and I interviewed to work in one of the top accounting firms in the country, I allowed my interviewers to talk about themselves most of the interview. After that, they told me how great it was to talk to me, not realizing that the whole time they mostly spoke about themselves. And then one of the partners told me, "Hey, listen, we actually hired another person that came right before you for the position that you're interviewing for. We had to finish the interviews, so we thought it was going to be short, but I had no idea how much I was going to connect with you. So I would love to offer you a different position that I think you would love so much more under my team." And that is how he hired me to work under his team, which was for state and local tax. So not only was the position that I applied for taken, but this man offered me a whole new position, a whole new job that no one else was even applying for because of how much he enjoyed speaking to me, all because I made him feel important during that interview. We just assume, regardless of what someone's position is in life, that, you know, they already know how important they are. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if someone is a barista at Starbucks or if someone is the CEO of a big company. Everyone wants the same thing, and that is to be appreciated with sincerity and to feel important. And the way you can do that is by remembering their name, listening when they speak, and showing intrigue by complimenting them sincerely about something that they have. So I hope you try it. It's such a simple rule, but so many people seem to miss it. And that is all for today's episode. And I hope you have a beautiful day. Love you, besties. I'll see you Thursday.